Kansas City Overland Park team. Details are online at martinpringle.com. It's 11 o'clock.
I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Even if you're not an art aficionado, chances are good you recognize the name and possibly the art of Pablo Picasso. So it's a pretty big deal when a gallery full of his work graces Kansas City. We're broadcasting live today from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art and a new exhibit, Through the Eyes of Picasso. We'll hear about the paintings, sculptures, and drawings on display and learn how art from around the world inspired his creative transformation. We'll also take a look at the story behind the aptly named Gates of Paradise, two intricately sculpted golden doors that weigh 4.5 tons. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Coming to you live this morning from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, where we're going to cover a double header of exciting developments. The exhibition of one of the most famous artists in humankind has opened. It's Through the Eyes of Picasso, and the exhibit will be here through April 8th. And the Nelson Atkins is the only museum in the entire country carrying the exhibit. Then there are the Gates of Paradise. They are 17 feet tall, weigh 4.5 tons, and they'll take your breath away. The Gates of Paradise, recently gifted to the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art and installed this summer, are simply amazing. Designed as the east doors for the Baptistry of St. John in Florence, Italy, back in the 1400s, they are a masterpiece of gilded bronze. Here to help us tell the story of this remarkable work are Monsignor Timothy Verdon. He's director of the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo in Florence, Italy. And Monsignor, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. It's very good to be here.
Clara Marinelli is also here. She's co-owner of the Frilli Gallery, also in Florence. And Clara, welcome to you as well.
Hello, Steve.
You know, there's a lot of history and significance attached to these doors, and you both have a direct connection to the work. Monsignor, start us off here with a description of the doors for our listeners who haven't seen them yet. I just saw them half an hour ago, and all the big words you can apply here all fit. They are something to be seen.
You've given the dimensions. What should be added is that the two valves of the double door have each five practically square panels depicting scenes from the Old Testament. Visitors to the museum will be able to identify easily many of the stories that most people still, I think, somehow learn.
Well-known biblical stories.
Well-known the biblical stories.
Mm-hmm.
And when the doors still hung on the baptistry, when these Old Testament stories opened, because the doors did function, they opened to admit people to the baptistry, what people saw was a colossal mosaic of Christ on the inside of the dome facing the doors. And that's obviously the way in which Christians have made use of these wonderful Old Testament stories as pointing toward Christ. I think to interpret the doors, one really has to allow that typically Christian perception, that historical and functional perception of the doors to work. The stories are told in very considerable detail. Ghiberti, the artist, in a single panel manages to put as many as 7 episodes of a single story.
Yes.
And in that way, he's able to tell the story so as to develop character, bring out features of personality, create suspense.
You know, Clara, you know, in looking at these things for the first time, one of my first reaction was, how could anybody do this? And what's your reaction to that?
Well, certainly Ghiberti was one of the biggest masters in Renaissance times, and it's no question that he was extremely skilled, and he had incredible support by older son, Vittorio Ghiberti, in working the beautiful casting of the bronzes.
I hope he had some help, because I wouldn't want to do that by myself.
He had a few other figures surrounding him, other artists. But the way the Frilly Gallery foundry cast these replicas is nothing too much distant from the way the Lost Wax casting would occur back in Ghiberti's time. Obviously, we have nowadays the aid of electricity and gas-ignited ovens, but what is true about these replicas is that they are masterfully cast and painstakingly chiseled in the same way Ghiberti and his pupils would have done that.
Ghiberti spent how long on this piece?
Ghiberti spent about
27 years.
Exactly.
27 years. That's remarkable in and of itself. Yeah. What else strikes you about these doors? What captures your attention when you look at them?
Well, many, many aspects, to be honest. The interesting thing that also Monsignor Verding was pointing out a few minutes ago is that in these scenes, there are several different episodes told. As Monsignor Verding was stating, there are 10 panels, but each panel doesn't tell only one story, but a few different steps contributing to the description of the panel.
And there's very helpful information boards nearby that help a newcomer sort of navigate what these different panels are, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. One of the panels that I like the most is the creation of Adam and Eve.
In the upper left-hand corner.
The creation of paradise and the expulsion of Adam and Eve from paradise. Mm-hmm. So what is interesting, again, as I was saying, is that in one single panel, Ghiberti is capable of telling us all of this, and he's in a way a predecessor of the film industry in a certain way. I know, I'm sure Monsignor Verdon is able to even explain this.
You're laughing, Monsignor, nodding your head. You think so too here, eh?
Absolutely. And the amazing thing is that where in that time it was more typical to tell stories in a linear way, reading from left to right, Ghiberti doesn't do that. Ghiberti puts the episodes where he feels they will have most visual impact, relying on what in his day was an audience that really knew the story so mm-hmm. well they could easily identify, but obliging that audience to reconstruct the plot through flashbacks. Mm. You see first one scene, then another, and you have to put it back together in its proper order. And of course, for anyone who either sees that in a film or sees it in a work of art, that makes the story much more interesting mm-hmm. because you are constructing it. You're winkling out the details, you're putting them back in their order, and at the end, you're more deeply touched, and it's become more truly yours than if it had simply been told A, B, C, D.
You know, you're so familiar with this work, Monsignor. What strikes you as when you approach it and look at it today? What grabs your attention?
What really surprises me, I'm an art historian as well as a priest, and I've been looking at these things and studying them for decades, and yet every time I take the time to stop and look at them again in the Museo dell'Opera, where we have the originals, or in front of the copy that is on the baptistry, or now in front of the beautiful copy here at the Nelson Atkins, I always discover something new. Mm-hmm. Always discover something new. I've been in New York on this trip to the States, inaugurating an exhibit by the famous Japanese photographer Hiroshi Sugimoto at the Japan Society, which consists of superb black and white photographs of these panels of Ghiberti's door. And he helped me see things that I'd never seen before.
Really?
So you can't say that any human object is infinite, but this is almost infinite.
And this is not something that a newcomer should approach and then spend 2 minutes in front of and walk away. You want to take this in for a few minutes. At least that would be my sense.
These were made for people's lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Claire, the material here is bronze, which I understand was more expensive than marble at the time. Do I have that right?
Well, I bet that it was expensive, surely. It was less difficult to procure, probably, in the sense that marble is a hard stone that was carved out of mountains and brought all the way down with oxes and with surely no cars were available back then. But alloy was definitely a very expensive material too. And we know that it wasn't easy to find either ways. And many Renaissance masters who used to cast in bronze who would run out of bronze themselves would probably use their own stovens at home. Mm-hmm. There is a remarkable episode written in the life of the artist written by Giorgio Vasari. We know for sure also from recent restoration occurring to a very famous sculpture in bronze that is in Florence, the Perseus by Benvenuto Cellini, that the alloy of which the bronze is made of, the sculpture is made of, is not consistent throughout each part of the sculpture.
Oh, that's interesting.
And he had problems in casting that sculpture, and at a certain point we know from this biography by Vasari that he added the stovens to dilute the bronze, that he hadn't left any bronze in order to cast the sculpture. So definitely it was a very difficult material to purchase and find.
If you're just joining us this morning or listening to Up to Date on KCUR, we're coming to you live from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. The opening of the Through the Eyes of Picasso exhibition has begun. We're talking for this segment about the Gates of Paradise just around the corner and down the hall from where we are right now. You know, Clara, your family operates this foundry in Florence that produces bronze works in all sizes. Can you tell us the method used to cast the panels of doors this size?
Well, each panel is cast separately, and the frames surrounding the doors which hold the panels together are also cast separately. I must admit that even the frames are incredibly well decorated and highly chiseled in the plans of Ghiberti, so he didn't really concentrate on the panels only, but he also marvelously thought about the frames, decorating the frames. So as I was saying, practically the techniques used are more or less the same that date back to the times of Ghiberti. The lost wax casting, it's quite a complex method, but the name itself explains it a bit, because everything starts from a wax model that it's usually obtained from molds, silicone molds. In this case, the replicas that are here installed in the Nelson Atkins Museum are replicas taken from original molds gypsum molds that were taken on the original Gates of Paradise right after World War II. Hmm. This gypsum are the starting point, practically, from where a wax model is done. Mm-hmm. And then from the wax model, which is highly chiseled, painstakingly chiseled by our workers, the wax model is practically covered in a refractory investment that it's made of sandy stones, very high resistant to heat.
Wow.
Stones.
Wow.
And this is put, I'm simplifying it obviously, this is put inside an oven, and what happens practically is that the wax melts, melts away, and the refractory investment, it remains hollow inside, and that's the moment in which through a hole, through a passage, the liquid bronze is poured in, and mm-hmm. that's how the bronze takes the place of the wax. So practically, the lost wax method is departing from a wax and then arriving to a bronze.
Huh. Monsignor Nelson Atkins, CEO Julian Zugasa-Goitia, has been so excited about the Gates of Paradise coming to this museum, one reason being the turning point they represent in the history of art, this masterful depiction of perspective. What did that mean when it comes to the Renaissance?
I understand Julian's enthusiasm for the doors, which really are one of the identity icons of the Renaissance. When Ghiberti completed the doors, he and his contemporaries understood that they had perfectly summed up all of the achievements of the preceding 50 years. He completed them in 1452, and they saw that the whole early Renaissance had been summed up. We're sitting here at the museum in Picasso's show, surrounded by works in which the great late 19th, early 20th century artists used the influences, the examples of African and Oceanic art in a similar way. Lorenzo Ghiberti in the early 15th century, the doors are done between 1425 and 1452, used what he knew of ancient classical art. So just as Picasso could render fascinating images to people of our time by incorporating distant echoes and memories of an ancient civilization, so Ghiberti had done in the Renaissance. Many of the figures really look like miniature classical statues. And then he inserts them in a visual space that is defined in the new way that had been invented in Florence just a few years before he began work on the doors, had been invented by his rival Filippo Brunelleschi. One of his objects was probably to show that he was fully in command of the new technique, the capacity to draw lines in such a way as to give the optical illusion of real spatial depth. Into that depth, then he inserts his figures.
Right.
Ghiberti manages to combine the ancient and the ultramodern in a way that astounded his contemporaries and gave them the sense that Florentines had by the time he finished the doors, a sense similar to that which Americans had after they put a man on the moon, of being on the cutting edge of, in this case, artistic technology.
You know, the gates, Monsignor, were installed in 1452. They remained in the baptistery until the 1960s when there was a flood. What happened to the doors then?
The doors were deeply shaken on their hinges by the rushing waters of the overflowing Arno, and by a kind of providential gift from above, just a few weeks before the flood, which occurred in early November 1966, new protective gates had been installed about 3 feet in front of the doors, and they were put up at night. They come out of the pavement. They're still in use, and they lock into place to prevent anyone from getting too close, ill-wishers from damaging the doors, and so on. Had the old gates been in place, the waters of the flood would have broken them open, and the panel, which actually came dislodged from its bedding in the frame of the door, would simply have been carried away.
Wow.
With this protective gate in the new system in place, the panel came loose and was held locked in that narrow envelope of space, and so, though slightly damaged, it could be restored and put back on the doors.
So we're lucky to have these doors here today.
Absolutely.
Very, very fortunate, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So a decision was finally made to remove the doors entirely for complete restoration. Why then, you know, what has been discovered about the condition of the doors at that point?
The principal thing we've learned in a restoration process that incredibly took as long as it took Ghiberti to make the doors. The restoration took 27 years. And it took that long because they did not know how to intervene upon the kind of gilding that Ghiberti used. The bronze doors are completely gilded except for the absolute minimum framing elements. And it's not the kind of gilding that is used today. We use what is called matte gilding. We simply apply gold leaf to a bronze surface with adhesives, and it gives a fine glittery look, but it's really all rather flat. Ghiberti used a technique called mercury gilding, which meant literally floating the gold leaf on an infinitesimally thin stratum layer of living mercury, which gave it a luminosity, a movement that the modern matte gilding does not give. But no one has used that. It's far too dangerous. since the early 19th century. And so the restorers didn't know how to go into that to remove the dirt without destroying the gilding. And it took years and years of experimentation wow. before they finally wow. learned. Once they learned, they were able to restore another door, Ghiberti's earlier door. We call it the North Door because it's on that side of the baptistry, in 2 years. So once you learn the process,
then it's easy.
Then it's easy.
Yeah. Well, Clara, pick up the story from here, because this is where your family comes into the picture. You and your gallery had a direct connection to a well-known foundry in Florence, the Marinelli Foundry, started by your grandfather and still in the family. How did it become involved with the Gates of Paradise?
So it became involved because my grandfather actually had bought the molds taken from the originals at the end of the Second World War by a professor, Italian professor and foundryman at that time, who was closely working in collaboration with the Opera del Duomo Institution.
Right.
He had been appointed by the Opera del Duomo to remove the Gates of Paradise during the Second World War, as well as the other two sets of doors that comprise the Florence Baptistry. And these gates were hidden for a long time in an unused railway tunnel leading up north. And when the Nazi decided on their runaway from Italy to use that railway again, the railway had to be emptied by from all this artworks that were hidden there. So they were brought back into town, many marvelous artworks that were hidden there, not only the Gates of Paradise, but other many famous artworks that were hidden there, were brought back into town. And then at that point, Bruno Bearzi, that was the name of the guy that was in charge of all of this, proposed to the Opera del Duomo to restore the Gates of Paradise and to take molds on of the original restored gates, in the perspective that might they would have come into helpful for any kind of purpose. There was already a dream in his mind that he could substitute the artwork with a replica, obviously cast by his foundry, but the Opera del Duomo back then wasn't ready to do so. So thanks God those molds were taken anyhow back then on a restored artwork, so they were very good quality molds. And it came into use after a few decades when the Opera del Duomo was ready to substitute the original works.
You know, Monsignor, the stories of these artworks are so magnificent. We learned last week a new biography of Leonardo da Vinci about how the Mona Lisa, how the great painter carried it around on a mule for years, and the fact that that painting survives like these gates, you almost can't believe it sometimes. What did you think when you found out that the gates would have a permanent home here in Kansas City as a result of a gift to the Nelson from Paul and Linda DeBruce?
I was very happy. We had moved the copies that are now at the Nelson Atkins around a bit. They traveled in India to exhibits at Mumbai and Calcutta. They traveled to Korea, an exhibit in Seoul. But that's a hard row to hoe. To move objects this big, this delicate, this heavy, continually around the world is yeah. staggeringly expensive. It's very dangerous. Indeed, they were supposed to come to New York for an exhibit I did there, but never made it because they were blocked for customs questions in India. And so to learn that, thanks to the generosity of Paul and Linda, DeBruce, the works would be in a major American museum, and if I may add, in a part of America where I was confident that people would recognize the Bible stories, perhaps not yeah. everywhere they would. But
that's still here. Yes, it still exists.
That's part of Kansas yeah. culture, I think.
Yes.
And I couldn't have been happier.
And just a quick note, the Marinelli Foundry art, there's several other pieces installed in Kansas City on the plaza. Maybe we'll talk about that later on this hour. I want to thank Museum Director Monsignor Timothy Verdon. Monsignor, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Clara Marinelli, co-owner of the Frilli Gallery in Florence. And Clara, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Picasso. Who else? We're coming to you live from the Nelson Atkins. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we spoke with former White House Press Secretary and KC native Josh Earnest about his time in the Obama White House. We also discussed sexual harassment and the Me Too hashtag campaign. You can find that conversation at kcur.org. Tomorrow, learn what life was like for a young American serviceman in World War I through the letters he sent back home to Nebraska. And we'll ask Mexico's ambassador to the U.S. about tending to international relations in the Trump age. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, again, we're back at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art and the world of Pablo Picasso. We're coming to you at the only site in the U.S. where this exhibit featuring the works of the fabled Picasso will be on display. The exhibit runs through April 8th. Ticket information is available on the museum's website. Joining me now to talk about Pablo Picasso are Julian Zugasagoitia. He's the CEO and director of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Julian, always good to have you here.
Great being here. Thank you.
Catherine Footer is also back. She's director of curatorial affairs here at the museum. Catherine, welcome to you.
Good morning.
You know, Julian, I know you love all the exhibitions here at the Nelson Atkins, but this one has to be extra special for you.
It is totally, because definitely when I came to Kansas City and first started engaging with the community and asking what are the shows you've seen, we had great feedback from people who remember Sacred Circles or the Great China Exhibition. But when I started also asking, what are the shows you would like to see? A lot of people would mention Picasso, and Picasso has a special significance for me, too.
And he does, Catherine, why? Why does he resonate with people to the extent that he does?
I think one of the reasons is because he's such an identifiable figure as a person. And then his art is so varied, and we think of Demoiselle d'Avignon, we think of Cubism, a little Surrealism. He lived a long time and had a really breadth of media he worked in.
You know Picasso when you see it, is what your point is.
Yes, I think you do. You always say, that's a Picasso, until you get confused by Braque.
How many works of Picasso are in this exhibition?
There are 71 Picassos in this 71. Exhibition, of all different kind of media.
Yeah. Well, Julian, Picasso has to have the longest name I've ever seen in my lifetime. If I try to say it, I just destroy it. Say his full name for us and then explain maybe why is it so long?
Well, in Spain, there's traditions of being named after saints or having almost names dedicated, and also to carry your father's name and your mother's name. So let me give it a try.
Good luck.
So the real name of Pablo Picasso is Pablo Diego José Francisco de Paula Juan Nepomuceno María de los Remedios Cipriano de la Santísima Trinidad Ruiz y Picasso.
I think there should be a round of applause for anyone to hear that. That's pretty good.
And Ruiz is his father's name, and Picasso was his mother's name, last name.
Julian, how did his discovery of African art transform Picasso and the work he was doing at the time?
So I think what this exhibition's premise and what it's beautiful of having all of these works, both Picasso work and African Oceanic and other works of art in dialogue, many of which he collected himself, is that Picasso at age of 20-something goes to the Trocadero Museum in 1907 and has a shock, and a shock that he describes in very palpable way with the smell, the emotions.
He didn't like it. He recoiled from it.
Indeed. He's having this reaction, and then he also finds that this is how he's going to find his way. His way as a painter and then as an artist. And I think all his life, he's in dialogue with these works of art. So the beginning of our show, we have works that he might have seen at the Palais Trocadéro coming from that collection, and then the works that he started collecting to be in dialogue with his works.
You know, Catherine, he decides at that point that his work, his lifetime work, is going to be in response to what he's seen at that museum, right?
Absolutely. I think what he really took away was challenging of form, of space, of pattern, of color. It transformed the way he saw the world. As tagging on to Julian, as he says, at that time he's a painter, and he looks at all these masks and sculptures, and he says, now I know what painting is about. So he took all that in, sort of digested it, and came up with a whole new vocabulary for himself.
So it transformed Picasso, and it certainly transformed modern art.
Absolutely. I think it was part of the zeitgeist. It was part of the air of people being interested in other cultures. He was not the only artist, because he actually gets stimulated by a piece that Matisse had, who he just bought. And Picasso grabs it out of his hands and won't let it go. And Picasso finally, at the end of the dinner party at Gertrude Stein, says, I'm going home. I'm exhausted. Please give me my piece back.
Really?
And then the story is that, what was it, a day afterwards, Julian? He comes back, Matisse goes, and from memory, Picasso had done sort of hundreds of drawings from this little African figure.
He's so moved by what he had
seen. Absolutely.
And what is it about that figure that grabbed him so much? What was it?
I think it was the intimacy, the scale, the surface, the way a figure was depicted, all the emotion of it. And there, we have a figure in the exhibition that's very similar to it, a Bembe figure. And I think it's my favorite work in the whole exhibition because it has this scale to it. You can feel, you can understand what it would feel like in your hand. You can see what the beautiful carving is, the facial expression. It really encaptures you in this very small, intimate object.
The other thing you take away from this, Julian, you know, very much like music, you see that, you know, Picasso was building on things that had come before him. And that's one of the joys and one of the beauties of art in all its forms. People are building on, in most cases, people are building on what's come before.
Totally. I think there's all great artists are not innocent artists. And in the sense, Picasso's saying also that he stole, like, from everyone. And actually, that is a legitimate version, is saying he's looking at everything and he's taking from all of those forms. One of the things also...
And that's just part of what art is, right? I mean, there's nothing questionable about that. We get into, you know, these scandals about plagiarism in the world, but this is something different.
Well, indeed, because that is exactly... You're taking from the masters, you're learning, you're taking, but also you're rejecting. And in the case of Picasso, for instance, and we have a notion early on, he's such a master by the age of 14... He is one of the great draftsmen, so he can paint better than his father, who was also a professional artist and a teacher. He's so good at painting that what he's looking and what he's discovering in these works of art is other ways of expressing. And I think he looks at this as masterpieces. Maybe there are unknown masters making this, but he sees this as incredible masterpieces that give another voice. So your analogy with music is correct also. When some composers are looking, like Stravinsky, to jazz or to African sounds, also at the same period, and this is concomitant. They're looking for something that is very original, authentic, and they're incorporating it into their voices. And so Picasso is escaping something that he dominates by age 14, that is classic representation, and looking into these masterpieces of Oceania or Africa, new ways that he feels affected profoundly. And he's trying to conquer and get that for his own art.
So, Catherine Footer, so what we have here in this exhibit is this bird's eye view of Picasso and his art combined with the influences that shaped him at this very critical point in his life. We're getting a comprehensive look at him and how his world was shaped by what he had seen.
Absolutely. I think
unique about this exhibit in some ways.
Yeah. And the fact that he lived with these objects through his entire life. So
they hung on his walls.
They hung in his walls. They leaned up against the walls. He moved them from studio to studio. He had about 11 studios. And there's this very poignant picture at the end of the exhibition which shows what happened to the global art, the African art, the Indonesia, the oceanic art, and it was sort of tossed away. And what was prized by the inventory were the Picassos. And yet he had prized these things his entire life and moved them. I mean, we have a Dimba figure that he bought in 1918 in the exhibition. That was there at the very end.
That's interesting. So how quickly after encountering African art did its influence start to appear in Picasso's work?
Well, the famous instance is he goes to the Trocadero in 1907, and he goes home, and he's already working on, or he goes to his studio, and he's already working on Demoiselle d'Avignon, and he redoes some of the faces, so it shows that influence of the African masks that he saw, that he'd taken them in, digested them, And again, there are 800 studies, and we have some of those studies in the exhibition.
So he turns it around pretty quickly.
Really quickly. There's a story about Brancusi, who Brancusi hated Picasso because after spending the afternoon with Picasso, he was exhausted and needed to go home and rest. And Picasso went home, went to his studio for 3 days and produced things from that encounter.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Tell us who he was again.
Brancusi was a very well-known modernist, very minimalist sculptor. And Nelson Atkins is very lucky to have a portrait of Nancy Cunard in the collection.
Again, if you're just joining us this morning, we're coming to you live from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. We're talking about Pablo Picasso and this startling, fantastic new exhibit that has just opened here. Julian Zugasagoiti, you know, Picasso began collecting African art and expanded to include oceanic art from the Pacific Islands, as we're talking about here. What did he collect specifically here?
So, again, I think it's important to remember that at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, these works of art are coming from what it is at the time, different colonies. And there was not the scholarship that we have today for this object. So for Picasso, he was not collecting from the perspective of trying to identify a civilization and a culture, whether it's from Oceania or from one of the different countries or cultures and civilizations from Africa. For him, it was objects that had very powerful figures, very geometrical elements, very formal components that he was going drawn to. So for him, and one of the things that I would say also, his collection is more an emotional collection and a formal collection than one of a scholarly collection.
So explain this to me. He's drawn to masks in some cases that have two noses.
Mm-hmm.
What drew him to that? I mean, what was the appeal?
I think there what he's seeing is that you can represent formally a human being or a face in a different way than the classic norm that he was taught to.
But we don't have two noses.
We don't. And one of the things he sees there, the expressivity of that. And actually, what cubism, that all of these early lessons lead to cubism. Cubism is an attempt to try to represent in a painting two or three different angles. And what I would say, if you take a picture of right now us in movement, and it's a bit blurry, you might end up having two noses, because if you move, and so that is what is being captured perhaps by this sculpture. So that is what Picasso allows to understand and say, maybe I can capture a face from three different angles in a painting. And that's what this sculpture is teaching them.
Just for the record, my nose is big enough as it is. I don't want two, Julian. I'll just take the one. Catherine, would you add anything to what Julian's saying there?
I think he put it really succinctly.
Yeah. You know, these pieces of Picasso's include paintings, sculptures, and ceramics. What's really neat is that the pieces from Picasso's personal collection are here, as we've talked about. What does that mean for the viewing experience of visitors here to the exhibition?
Well, I think you can really see, you can start to explore what Picasso was looking at,
mm-hmm.
and you really can start understanding. And in a very didactic way, you can start looking at the different elements, the forms, the figures, the space. There's a crew mask that Picasso owned, and then right nearby is a guitar that he made out of tin. He originally made it out of paper. And it's not that they're identical in any way, but the way the crew mask has geometry and space and pattern, and then you look at the Picasso and you start making those linkages and you start seeing that kind of what was drawing him to those objects.
You know, Catherine, you did such a great job explaining Impressionist art to me back when we were here for the opening of the Block Galleries. Let's give Picasso a shot here. Right across from where we're seated here in the Nelson Atkins are these sculptures. Are all of these Picasso's work that we're looking at here, or is one of his collected pieces in here too?
So actually one of them in the center is a Dimba from the Baga culture, mm-hmm. In Africa. And also
Describe it to us.
Would say that it's a big mask. It weighs about 65 to 80 pounds, made out of wood, carved wood, with a big face with a very prominent nose, hooked nose, small ears that project out, and a very tiny little mouth. So Dimba is a figure, I missed one very important thing. She has very big breasts. And Dimba is it's almost like an earth mother figure, mm-hmm. in the Baga culture. And she listens well. That's why she has a projecting ear. And she chooses her words wisely, a small mouth. And she's born lots of children. So that's why she has the breasts. If we look to the right of that figure, we see a sculpture of Marie Therese, sorry, the left of
left.
It, sorry.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you for pointing that out. The left is a figure, a sort of portrait of Picasso's mistress, much, much younger mistress, by the way. When he met her, she was 17 and he was 46. And Marie Therese became his mistress,
And
he did a sculpture of her. And you can see that relationship. Her nose is rather extended. If we go even further to the left, there's a print that Picasso did soon after he met her, very realistic. So you can see he's still playing with the realism, but he's now abstracted it, and he's learning from what he sees in the Dimba mask, and he owned two of these Dimba masks. One he bought from Gertrude Stein in 1918, and extrapolating from there.
Julian, just knowing you, I bet you would have loved to have spent time in Picasso's studio asking him, what's he thinking, what's he doing, where's he going with all this, right?
Totally. But, you know, one of the greatest lucks of my lifetime has been to meet David Douglas Duncan, the photographer who had extended
with Kansas
time.
City roots.
And he's a Kansas Cityan, he's a local hero, and he'll spend a lot of time with Picasso. We have photographs that he donated to the Nelson, documenting the life of Picasso in his last studios. So that is our closest connection. And today is a very special day. Today we're celebrating the birthday of Picasso. Picasso was born October 25th, 1881. So it's so auspicious to have KCUR live from the Nelson.
There you go. You did that very well.
Very well.
Catherine, how can visitors tell which are the artist's work and which are objects of original African art here?
Sometimes it's a little tricky. We have one case of carved wood figures, and Julian likes to test people which are the African pieces and which are the Picassos, because sometimes he is, and especially when he's trying a new medium, I think that he's maybe a little closer. But one of the things we do point out in the exhibition, besides the different cultures, is what objects were owned by Picasso. So we call those out very easily so that you know that he lived with these objects.
Now, one big other meaty question here. What in his approach made Picasso's creations different from the pieces that inspired him? How did he transform them in his representations, Catherine?
Well, I think he made them into what we would consider sort of European and American art. What is art? It is a decorative, like a painting to hang on a wall. And many of these objects that are from the different cultures are functional, have a function. A mask would be used in a different ritual or ceremony. A wall painting might be a door or covering. So it had a very different function, an end life, let's say, and had a different, very different place in the culture.
Hey, well, what's your take on that, Julian? How Pablo Picasso spun these things?
So I think one of the great things that you see throughout the exhibition is that Pablo Picasso changes styles constantly, but there's something that is deep and common to it. And so he's in search of what he says in a quote also that I think is very famous and I never got exactly, but he says, all my life I'm trying to get to the spontaneity of children painting or playing with paint. So what you get is through all this, he's looking at things that will free him up to be spontaneous. And so that's why there's never a direct quote, but he's always evolving.
Did Picasso, Catherine, try mediums he hadn't used before in creating these works?
Constantly. One of the things that he did was take objects that he found on the street, literally went with his lady friend with a baby carriage and filled it up with things that he found and then created new objects. Or he took his son Claude's toy car and made it into the head of a baboon. So he was always picking up and thinking of new media. He meets Jacqueline and he starts doing ceramics. I mean, it's man was so restless creatively.
Julian, this museum, the Nelson Atkins, is the only one in this country to get this exhibit. How did you land it?
It's both a lot of work and a lot of good contacts and a good collaboration with the Musée du Quai Branly, with whom we did Plain Indians, and so that helped. And the fact that the current director of the Musée Picasso has been a long-standing friend, so it's both luck, personal relationships, and sometimes also the fact that we have this incredible institution with also a great collection of African art. And when this exhibition was being put together, the fact that we have such a rich collection of African art helped to the lenders say, yes, this is the place where you should go.
Well, and relationships always help, and you've got a lot of them. That's Julian Zugasa-Goitia, the CEO and director of the Nelson Atkins. Catherine Footer, director of curatorial affairs. Thank you both for a very good explanation of what we've been looking at here today. Appreciate
Thank
it very
you,
Steve. Much.
And we love having life from the Nelson Atkins, so anytime.
Thanks, Leon. Connolly is back, even though we're at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art with this week's Local Listen. He was kind enough to join us here in the Black Building at the Nelson. And Bill, always good to have you here.
This is an exciting exhibit, Steve.
And we're going from Pablo Picasso very quickly to a group called Freight Train Rabbit Killer. This is kind of a transition here, Bill.
Maybe not as much as you think. I think Picasso would have...
Thank you for bailing me out there.
And appreciated Freight Train Rabbit Killer. There's a primal, primitive, sensual aspect to this Kansas City duo's music that is very much reminiscent of Picasso.
Well, let's check it out. This is Maybe It's You from Freight Train Rabbit Killer. That's Freight Train Rabbit Killer, the track Maybe It's You. That's the B-side of a new 7-inch vinyl single. And Bill, lots going on here. We've got the blues, we've got some rock, and I've got the heebie-jeebies. What are you picking up on in this song?
Yeah, these guys take the creepy blues of John Lee Hooker and Robert Johnson and drag it kicking and screaming into the new millennium.
Did I hear a saw in that mix, as in like cutting wood with a saw?
You know, with these guys, what's interesting is there are conventional elements, acoustic, organic sounds, as well as contemporary production flourishes. So it's hard to tell which is which, and it really doesn't matter.
This seems to be a pretty appropriate musical pick for the weekend before Halloween, I think.
That's right. These guys wear masks as they perform. Sometimes they pass props out to members of the audience. So they have two Halloweenish shows this weekend. One Saturday down in the brewery that's in the side of the Golden Ox, you'll remember, in the Stockyards.
Sure.
And the second show is Sunday at the Record Bar.
So given the masks, it's fair to say that Picasso might have been a fan of a band like this.
I know if I attend one of these shows, I'll be going as one of the sculptures I see in front of us here.
Okay. Just quickly, you say there's a series of upcoming releases that will lead listeners to a literal trove of artifacts.
That's right. If you collect all four singles that'll be coming out, you can put them together, look at the treasure map, and locate all kinds of Freight Train Rabbit Killer surprises.
Okay, that's Bill Brownlee with this week's Local Listen. The group again, Freight Train Rabbit Killer. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, meet Mexico's ambassador to the U.S. and learn what the life of a World War I serviceman was like through the letters that he sent home. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.